This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. While he wasn't born here, Wisconsinites are proud to claim Harry Houdini because of the time that he lived in Appleton as a young man. He was a nationally known and loved escape artist and performer. But what hasn't gotten as much attention is his skill as an inventor. That talent made a lot of his most incredible illusions possible.
Jackson Landers is an author, science writer, and adventurer. His Smithsonian article, Escape Artist Harry Houdini Was an Ingenious Inventor He Just Didn't Want Anybody to Know, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Jackson, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, how did Harry Houdini first get interested in magic and in tinkering on the things that helped him do these amazing escapes?
He started getting into magic as a teenager, and he came out of this tradition of song and dance, and it was vaudeville, really. And he and his brothers had a vaudeville act, and it really grew from there. And his brother Hardine also performed as Houdini for the rest of his life.
Oh, really?
Two Houdinis.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
Were some people disappointed if they bought tickets to the wrong Houdini?
Yeah, that actually happened quite a lot. Of course, his brother performed as Hardine Houdini, but his whole life he was plagued by imitators. As soon as his name kind of gained some sort of currency as the great Houdini, this was a problem in different countries. And he would be in Europe performing, and there'd be someone putting up posters in New York saying that they were the great Houdini, and he was always fighting imitators. This is a big part of why he innovated, because he had to stay ahead of them. You know, he learned these great handcuff escape acts. And then his imitators kind of caught up and learned how to do that, so he had to come up with something else and something else that the imitators couldn't do. But yeah, this was a big problem his whole career.
And something that people don't think about or know about, I didn't, with Harry Houdini, was that he was a tinkerer and an inventor, and that's a lot of what you're writing about. What kind of things did he do?
His tinkering begins with just kind of figuring out how locks work, how handcuffs work, and he becomes very, mechanically inclined, I think, through that, figuring out how these locks work and how can he hide some little lock pick or something, you know, in order to get that open. So he's thinking very three-dimensionally. When he starts designing his own tricks, when he comes out of this sort of handcuff phase, he starts designing these elaborate, like, you know, boxes, or like he has a giant milk can filled with water that he's dropped into, and he has to escape from that. So it's as he's coming up with these more and more elaborate tricks, that's where this comes from. And of course, you know, he's imitating other things also. He's building on what previous magicians have done. And so much of what he did as an innovator, we can just guess at, because magic is about secrecy. And in fact, even some of the modern magicians who own some of his tricks will actually lie about how they work. They still want to protect his secrets.
Well, an amazing thing with these is when somebody invented something in those days or today, their first trip might be to the patent office to register it, to make sure nobody rips this off. That would really go against that whole secrecy idea, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and so early on he kind of dabbled with filing patents. There were a few patents actually in the United Kingdom. He began the process of filing a few patents and then stopped, which suggests that, you know, he realized he was going to have a problem. When you file a patent, you have to explain how your invention works, and then other people can imitate it. But he did take he took a number of different approaches to trying to protect his intellectual property, as it were. In fact, in one case, and he only did this once, and I'm not sure why, but he had come up with this trick what we call a water torture trick, where he would be suspended upside down, from his ankles, and lowered slowly into this tank of water that it looks like he should drown in, and then he's sort of like locked down, and he gets out of this box, and he's very worried about people copying him. And so rather than patenting the mechanics of the box per se, he put on a performance in I believe it was in England. He put on a performance, and he called it a one-act play called Houdini Upside Down. And so he was able to retain intellectual property over the performance as a piece of art rather than a patent. And on at least one occasion, someone who was trying to copy a woman who was trying to copy the Chinese water torture cell, he did successfully bring a case against her and force her to stop because of this one-act play.
And this one-act play was originally performed, I think you wrote, for an audience of one?
Yeah, exactly.
Just to put it in the books.
Just to put it in the books, just to have that intellectual property. And that was but more often, you know, more often he protected his tricks just with secrecy. He did have a few patents. He did have a few other patents. There's one in particular. He invented when he went through a phase of his career where he was doing a lot of underwater escapes. He became, you know, really well. He was famous for everything he did, but this sort of defined him for a while, doing these underwater escapes. And he's figuring out these mechanics for getting out of something underwater, and he sort of realizes that, you know, maybe this could save people's lives if he came up with a quick-releasing diving suit. You know, this is before the age of modern scuba equipment, and so there were these kind of cumbersome diving suits where you could get stuck in one and you could die. It was a dangerous thing to do. And so he comes up with this quick-release system for getting out of a diving suit and thinks, you know, this can help people. He files a patent, and then he gives it to the United States Navy.
We're talking to Jackson Landers. He's an author, science writer, and adventurer. His Smithsonian article, Escape Artist Harry Houdini Was an Ingenious Inventor He Just Didn't Want Anybody to Know, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. You tell in your piece, Jackson, the story of one piece of equipment bought at an auction by, I think it was Teller from Penn and Teller, this thing that Houdini could be strapped to and suddenly escape from a whole bunch of ropes. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, so Teller told me about this. Teller from the great magical duo Penn and Teller. And Teller is actually a great scholar of history and of Teller and of Houdini in particular. But he was examining. Teller had the opportunity to examine this piece of equipment where, yeah, you would have these ropes that he would get out of very quickly. And it's a little bit difficult to describe this on the radio, but if you can imagine, there are, you know, things that you could put a rope through. Well, you know, people would put their fingers in there. And he was warned, no, you got to get your finger – keep kids away from this, because there were actually hidden blades. It was like a little guillotine, these holes that the ropes would go through. There was some little hidden button he could press that would just instantly slice all of those ropes. and so to this day, you have to keep kids away from it.
And Houdini approached magic very clearly not as a supernatural phenomenon, right? He was an early example of the magician as skeptic.
Yeah, which is particularly interesting because he comes, he emerges from this this sort of tradition that is of spiritualism, and that's where the whole idea of escape acts came from in the first place. I mean, Houdini has come to define the idea of the escape artist. He was not the first escape artist by any means, and it was an act, really, especially coming out of the Civil War in the 1860s to the 1890s. There were a lot of these spiritualists who would, you know, they were doing a number of things in their acts. They were claiming to communicate with the dead, and they would have these sort of apparent miracles that they said the spirits were helping them escape from something, or them dematerializing here and rematerializing in the other room outside of the ropes. And it was, of course, it was hocus pocus. It was nonsense. But that's where the whole idea of these escape acts come from. But Houdini doesn't want to. He doesn't buy into any of it. And in fact, his whole life, the only tricks that he betrayed. I mean, there's a code where magicians do not tell anyone how each other's tricks work. And he was willing to break that rule if it was to expose somebody who was claiming to be doing something by supernatural means. But I think it's part of he kind of starts this intellectual tradition that I think, you know, you see today with people like, you know, Bill Nye, and maybe the amazing Randi, mm-hmm. You know, this kind of pro-science, anti-hocus-pocus, you know, this philosophy. I think he's a big part of where this comes from.
Are there still tricks, escapes, and other things that Houdini did that, as far as we know, no one has figured out yet?
Yeah, there definitely are, and there are tricks where some people say that they've figured it out, and then like, for example, there's one trick. He made an elephant disappear on stage, and people have a number of different theories of how he did it. There's more than one way to do a lot of these tricks. So just because you can come up with a way that he could have done something doesn't mean that's exactly the way that he took. But yeah, he made an elephant disappear on stage, and there's some very good theories of how he did it, but we still don't know. The Chinese water torture cell, that's another one where he was, and I mentioned earlier, where he's suspended upside down and dropped into the water. Or his milk can escape, where he escaped from the milk can in the water. People have been able to reproduce those tricks, but it's not clear that they're doing them the way that he was. So there's quite a lot about Houdini that we really don't know.
Houdini was also a wizard of self-publicity, it sounds like. Can you talk about how he was able to not just have this talent, but to get that talent exposed to the public?
Yeah, I think Teller really said it best when he told me, when I was talking to him, he told me that Houdini's real stage was not the stage, it was the newspapers. and to a certain extent, I think that's true. He wouldn't just, show up in a city to, go to a vaudeville theater and do his escape act. He wasn't happy, just kind of performing in the conventional way everyone else did. He would arrive in a new city, a week early, and he would go to the police station. And he'd say, "I want you to lock me up in as many pairs of your toughest handcuffs and put me in your safest cell, lock me in naked, and I'm going to get out." And very often they would go along with it. And then now you have, a piece of news, and the local newspapers would come and cover it, and the police officers would, kind of get a kick out of doing this. They wanted to show off their cell. And sometimes they'd learn a few things from Houdini. And he would do things like that. So he would build this publicity. And then, of course, because every single time he would manage to get out of the handcuffs, he'd manage to get out of the cell. And so, nobody wants to say, yeah, my handcuffs are just lousy. Our cell has low security. So these police officers and jailers are put in this position where they just have to say, well, Houdini is just so brilliant. the problem is my handcuffs. The problem is that Houdini is just a master. And they would praise him. And he built a reputation by doing these sort of big media events that then would result in the theaters just being packed.
He also made it into the movies, and he and others said, movies kind of kill the whole escape concept because you don't know if it's a special effect or not.
Yeah, and he was very aware of that. I mean, he was an early adopter. He knew film was going to be a big deal. As soon as he could get himself on camera and start making movies, he knew that this was a vehicle for his brand. And he wanted to be on camera in part because he had such an amazing physique for the time. You look at pictures, this is a guy who's in really good shape. And this is at a time when Americans are maybe starting to get kind of fat and out of shape. They're moving from a rural lifestyle into an urban lifestyle. They're not farming. And there's kind of an awareness that something has been lost. And so he has this physique that he wants to show off, this idea of his manliness, and he can do this on camera. And so very early on, he wanted to use movies, but he knew that there'd be, tricks that people would resort to. And we think of, that in terms of, computer effects now being really advanced. But right away, within just a few years of being able to film stuff, people were finding ways of, doing kind of the equivalent of CGI at the time, splicing things in and out. And he became an actor and actually wasn't, if you watch his movies, considering the time and the fact that he wasn't professionally trained, he wasn't bad. He was doing a lot of stuff that was sort of science fiction inspired.
And before I let you go, you write that the idea of the escape as performance appealed in particular to a big immigrant culture in the United States who had just made a big maybe escape of their own.
Yeah, I mean, this is a time when there's a lot of instability in Europe, and some of the places he's performing, he's performing in Russia at a time when it was locked down. I mean, people weren't serfs anymore, but that whole everyone was controlled, by the state government. And the same thing in Germany, pre-World War I, the Kaiser's in control, everything. It's a very locked down society where you have to ask permission for everything. And then in America, you had these immigrants who'd been running away from those kinds of governments. And the idea of escape was really appealing. I think it resonated with people in a way that maybe it hasn't since until now, as we're seeing, a lot of parts of the world where people are trying. We have so many refugees from different parts of the world, refugees from Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan. And I wonder if maybe Houdini is a little more relevant today than he has been for a long time.
Jackson, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jackson Landers. His Smithsonian article, Escape Artist Harry Houdini Was an Ingenious Inventor He Just Didn't Want Anybody to Know, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the human body does a lot of amazing and sometimes perplexing things. We'll talk to the author of the book, If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body.
First, State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has proposed a new bill that has some environmental groups concerned. The bill would ease up regulations on high-capacity wells, which can draw around 100,000 gallons of water a day.
Supporters of less regulation on these high-capacity wells have argued that the agricultural economy and other key industries rely on these wells and also allow for job growth. Environmentalists, on the other hand, have highlighted the well's possible link to dwindling water levels in lakes and rivers in Wisconsin.
Dee Hall joins us now to tell us more. She's the managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, which has reported extensively on water quality here in Wisconsin. Dee, welcome back.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Well, Dee, how could this bill loosen regulations if it becomes a law? What would happen?
Well, this is the latest attempt by the legislature to try to create some settled law in this area. What this bill would do would require that well owners who are replacing a current well or fixing a current well would not have to go in for new permit application. And environmentalists say that these are among the few perpetual permits, and by allowing them to just constantly be extended and rolled over, that you lack some of the protections to come back in and say, is this permit still doing what it should do?
And this has been a highly charged issue for environmentalists and advocates of loosening regulations on high-capacity wells for quite a while. What do the advocates say about why it's necessary to make it a little bit easier for people to get these permits or at least to maintain them?
Well, DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp has essentially said, please step in here, because you have dueling court rulings, you have lawsuits. There are some legal challenges to a set of permits that were issued back in the fall, and it's just a very contentious part of the DNR's enforcement capabilities. And, you know, so she's been asking for, let's get some certainty in here. Let's say exactly when we need to issue these permits, what we need to decide, what information we need to decide on them, and what are the circumstances under which a new review or other regulatory action needs to be taken.
And what about environmentalists? What do they say about why they're opposed to some of these measures?
Well, you mentioned it earlier. It's the drying up of some lakes and streams. We did some stories several years ago at wisconsinwatch.org in which we had some pretty dramatic photos showing docks that just went out into the middle of a little weedy patch, and that used to be a trophy fish lake. And so there are people who live around these lakes who are very concerned about the reality that they are seeing, which is some of these streams and lakes are drying up. So at this point, what the environmental groups would like to see the opposite happen. They would like to make sure that every time a permit is changed in any way, if there's a new well of any kind, that it go through a DNR review, and that they are able to take into account what are called cumulative impacts of all the existing wells in the area.
Is there a documented scientific consensus on the connection between high-capacity wells and diminishing water levels? Do we know that that is what's going on?
Well, I think the potato growers and vegetable growers dispute that the wells that they use to water their crops, especially in the Central Sands area, are directly responsible. They've cited some climate change issues. And, you know, so there is a disagreement there, frankly. One thing this bill would do, which the environmentalists are glad about, at least halfway glad about, is that it would call for a study in the Central Sands, parts of the Central Sands, to determine whether, in fact, these particular wells in this area are creating a drawdown that is unacceptable, and that they would have to finish that study within about 3 years.
Well, let's talk about where it stands right now, because last year there was legislation introduced kind of similar to the legislation now. It didn't make it all the way. And then Attorney General Brad Schimmel was asked to write an opinion about this, and that changed things a little bit. Tell us about what happened there in all of this maneuvering back and forth.
So the opinion that the Attorney General issued essentially said that the DNR does not have the legal or statutory authority to put this condition on wells, that you know, the impact of your well added to the impact of any other high-capacity wells can be a basis for denying you a well permit. And so that was issued last year, which, you know, for those who, the groups that are hoping for more clarity here, are we're cheering that, saying, good, you know, you just have to look at each well one at a time and decide whether it is You know, whether it is permissible, and you can't, you know, ding us, for example, for the fact that somebody down the road has also has a high capacity well. So as you can imagine, environmentalists would like those cumulative impacts taken into account, because what they're seeing is rivers and streams that are drying up, rivers, streams and lakes that are drying up in the Central Sands area.
So as of right now, what is the procedure? Who's deciding?
Well, it's still a DNR process, but the DNR has to, you know, use other criteria, not cumulative impacts, in deciding whether to issue a well permit.
So does that mean right now it is currently easier than it would have been a year ago?
I don't know about a year ago, but yes, at times in the past it would have been easy. It would have been more difficult because the DNR was for a while taking into account cumulative impacts. So you would have to show that your well would not create a problem with any of the navigable rivers or waters in the area. An example here is one of the legal challenges that Clean Wisconsin filed, and the DNR had decided that 36.3 million gallons a year would be enough for this particular well, and the after this ruling, the well was approved, and it's going to take apparently 272 million gallons of water. So there's just a big divergence between what some scientists would say is an acceptable level of pumping in these areas and what some of the agricultural interests want to have.
Now, Dee, as I understand it, this bill was sent to the Committee on Labor and Regulatory Reform, not to the Senate's Natural Resource Committee, which looks at wells and groundwater issues. Why was that?
That, I wish I could answer that question. It's unclear to me why. That's obviously not the normal course for this type of legislation, but, you know, Scott Fitzgerald does run the Senate, and he can do as he wishes in this particular regard.
I want to talk about, and you touched on this earlier, that the Little Plover River as a common case study for the impacts of high-capacity wells. Tell us about that study and what it found.
Well, that area has been studied for a long time by George Kraft, and he is a UW-Stevens Point professor, and he has concluded, he doesn't have any doubt in his mind that the pumping in that area has drawn that down to below acceptable levels. But that is the area, that's one of the areas that's under great dispute right now by the vegetable and potato growers. They believe that there are other things that could be causing the drawdowns, and that you can't tie it to any particular wells in those areas.
Do we know what those other things are that they're proposing as a separate reasoning for what's going on?
A climate variability is one of them that's been mentioned. We did have a drought several years back, and during that time period, many places were seeing a lack of water, and so that's one of the causes that's being cited by the agricultural interests.
Do we know whether there would be measurable benefit to maybe Wisconsin's frac sand industry, Wisconsin's agricultural industry in economic terms, if it were perhaps easier and there were a more certain process for getting these permitting on high capacity wells?
I think that's the argument that's being made, is that, you know, these agriculture, you know, frac sand mining, you have dairy industry, large dairy farms that need a lot of water, and they often have high capacity wells. Then you have potatoes, for example, that are grown in the Central Sands, and per its name, the soil there is very sandy, and the water goes right through it. And so they circulate a lot of water through those crops. And if you can't do that, then you can't keep the kind of yields up that they have right now. And so those are the arguments. That's a classic, I think we called it a fish versus farmer debate when we wrote about it several years ago, that's going on.
Is that how it breaks down? I mean, is this being put forward by Scott Fitzgerald, but is this necessarily a partisan issue?
It has been so far, yeah. I mean, this is a Republican bill. There aren't any Democratic co-sponsors. There are Democrats who have... It became actually an issue in this last election. One of the incumbents from the area, Scott Krug, had, you know, there were some debates brought by his challengers about whether he was going to be protecting the environment or, you know, giving in, quote unquote, to agricultural interests. He did win his reelection. So it's just a very contentious issue in parts of the state, especially the Central Sands, because it is the water table is so so influenced by the groundwater. The surface water is heavily influenced by the groundwater, and that's why people like George Kraft have said that the stuff that you draw from the groundwater has a direct impact on how much surface water you have and where it is.
And you mentioned some pending lawsuits surrounding some of the permitting that happened previously. What do we know about those lawsuits and whether they could have an impact on how this plays out?
Well, it's hard to say. I think one goal of a law like this is to get this on the books so that by the time these other lawsuits are decided, that the state will have made a declarative law saying, yes, you can take cumulative impacts into account, or no, you can't.
Dee, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
That was Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And she's with us here in studio. We were talking about a new proposed legislation that could ease regulations on high-capacity wells, which conservationists have opposed.